On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our nation saw a record number of gun-related deaths in 2020. That's the most recent full year of data available. Pew Research breaking it down. Nearly 8 in 10 murders involved a gun. Closer to home, Milwaukee leaders, they continue to deal with the aftermath of the shooting sprees near the Deer District that injured 21 people after the Bucks playoff game 10 days ago. Join in on gun-related policy, where the conversation goes from here, on background checks, semi-automatic assault weapons, concealed carry. Your message to lawmakers on guns, 800-642-1234. Jerry Bonavia is a founding director of Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort Educational Fund, or WAVE. It's a group working to reduce gun violence. Jerry, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning, and thank you for having me.
Good morning. Before we get too deeply into policy, you've been working in this area of working to reduce gun violence for more than 25 years. What has changed?
I think one of the major things that has changed is the politicization of the issue, at least within the halls of the Capitol in Madison and in D.C. So where once we could find some common ground and take some steps in reaction to what we're seeing, that doesn't seem possible anymore, even though the vast majority of citizens are in agreement about what we could be doing.
So, you know, the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, it gives Americans the right to bear arms. But as you're saying, most gun policy proposals, whether they're at the federal or state level, are very politically divisive. Here in Wisconsin, is it possible then to find that common ground and any new restrictions that you think both Democrats and Republicans would be on board with?
Yeah, exactly. So, again, I think the key thing to keep in mind is that while our politicians are divided on this issue, the citizens are not. So even in a divided state like Wisconsin, we find that if you ask the public about various types of gun violence prevention policies, we are in agreement. Sometimes 80, 85, 90% of us agree. Where the division is seen is among the politicians, among the Democrats and Republicans in the Capitol.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that they have, at least in part, become kind of consistently working for special interest groups rather than for the citizens that they supposedly represent. And I think a lot of that can be attributed to the severe gerrymandering that we have in our state so that they are, you know, in safe seats. They don't have to worry about reelection. They don't have to worry about being accountable to the people who elect them.
People opposed to gun control laws have argued that they need the firepower, right, to protect themselves against criminals. And they say that a vast number of crimes are prevented by armed citizens. How often do gun owners prevent shootings? What do you see there?
Yeah, so it's just not true that, you know, the scenario that the good guys are stopping the bad guys. It is a favorite talking point of the gun lobby, but that's not how things work in the real world. What really happens is that a lot of people are buying guns and have guns in their home, and those guns end up being used in ways that the purchaser, you know, didn't anticipate. So they end up being used, sadly, in the completion of a firearm suicide or in acts of domestic violence, and they aren't used to ward off the bad guys.
We're discussing policy aimed at reducing gun violence. Want to hear from you on it. Jerry Bonavia, founding director of Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort Educational Fund, with us. Join in on what policies you want to see, what laws you want in place. 800-642-1234. Jerry, I want to direct our attention to the state Supreme Court ruling Friday that a disorderly conduct charge doesn't disqualify someone from holding a concealed weapon permit. And this is the case that involved a man who was convicted of breaking into his estranged wife's home and threatening to kill her. He will be allowed to carry a concealed gun in Wisconsin. What do you see as the impact of this ruling?
I think it's horrible. You know, here in the state of Wisconsin, we don't have domestic violence laws that mirror federal law. What we do is we charge people who have committed acts of domestic violence under other statutes, so under battery or under, in this case, disorderly conduct. And what the Supreme Court in Wisconsin said was that, yes, the actions of the person were absolutely domestic violence, but because the person was charged under disorderly conduct and because our disorderly conduct statute does not mirror the domestic violence statute of federal law, it can't be considered domestic violence, and therefore the person cannot be prohibited from having a concealed carry license. I mean, clearly this is a demonstration of how the law is just wrong. It puts us in more danger, and it needs to be fixed. And we're calling on Governor Evers to call for a special session and pull the legislature back into session to fix this egregious problem.
Justice Jill Karofsky gave several ways that lawmakers could fix this loophole, and one was creating a new domestic violence law specific to threatened use of a deadly weapon. Another was make domestic violence its own category of crime, or make a law giving courts the authority to judge whether a given, conviction constitutes domestic violence. What approach would you go about fixing this?
Yeah, so she was exactly right. And I think it almost doesn't matter which route we take. We just need to take action, because clearly this kind of event should not be allowed in the state of Wisconsin. People who do these things should not be allowed to have firearms, because we know that one of the best predictors of future violence is past violence. And clearly this is a case of violence where the person should not be allowed to have a firearm.
And Karofsky very much pointing to the legislature to figure this out. Do you think the legislature will hear that plea from, the state Supreme Court?
Well, I certainly hope so. I certainly hope that they recognize what kind of danger particularly women and children are in because of this ruling. And again, we ask Governor Evers to call a special session immediately. This cannot wait. And I'll just add that the legislature has known about this problem for many, many years. We have gone to them. The domestic violence prevention groups have gone to them and asked them to fix this. Even this session, there was bipartisan legislation that didn't move forward, didn't get a hearing even, and it is absolutely time for our legislature to step it up.
Jerry Bonavia with us runs the Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort Educational Fund, a grassroots gun control group founded in 1997. Join in on Stand Your Ground, on violence prevention measures you support, on ghost guns, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap with Jerry Bonavia here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kedar Chirkent. We're talking about the path forward for gun-related policies in Wisconsin. On the federal level, congressional efforts to change gun policies significantly have failed. And 9 days ago, another tragedy, a racist attack at a grocery store in Buffalo, left 10 dead. The Buffalo shooter's AR-style gun was legal when he purchased it, and he skirted New York's red flag law. Join in, 800-642-1234. Jerry Bonavia leads the Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort Education Fund with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring in, let's see here, Andrew from Oconomowoc. Andrew, hi.
Hi there. I was just calling because your guest had mentioned that the idea of calling or that a good guy with a gun is going to show up and prevent a violent crime from occurring is silliness. But the one question I would have is if you believe that that's fake and that that doesn't occur, why call police? Or in the case of a female, why remove that right to equalize the playing field? If she's being assaulted by a male, why remove that right from her?
Andrew, thank you. Jerry, go ahead.
Yes, I just want to be clear. I didn't call it silliness. What I did point out is that that type of situation, you know, does not happen. Generally speaking, what we see is that guns that are purchased for protection end up not being used that way. So in the example that you gave of a woman having a gun to kind of equal the playing field, what we know is that that intention may be good, but what really happens is that the woman in that case is at greater risk, not less. And so that gun that she purchases for protection ends up being used in ways that she didn't intend. So it's used against her in acts of domestic violence, or it's used by another person in her household, self-directed injuries, or a number of different scenarios. So I understand all of us want to feel safe, and all of us try to think of ways that we can keep ourselves safe. It's just that that doesn't turn out the way that we might anticipate when we're buying a gun for protection.
Gun sales have really spiked, especially early in the pandemic. A lot more people also isolated in crisis. What do you make of the 70% spike in homicides from 2019 to 2021 in Wisconsin?
Well, really sadly, we anticipated this increase based on the soaring gun sale numbers that we were seeing at the start of the pandemic. And so it's not surprising, it's horrifying, but hopefully what people are seeing is that connection, that as we see spikes in gun sales, what follows in the months and years after are spikes in homicides, spikes in firearm suicides, and unintentional shootings. And hopefully people will start rethinking whether they want to have a gun in their home or not. Now, you know, what we do is try to have people understand the risk factors, because the risk of gun ownership is not equal across all households. So if your household has, for example, a history of alcohol or drug abuse or a history of violence, those risk factors start piling up, and it might not be a good idea to have a gun in the home.
Let's go to Milt now in Madison. Milt, hi. What's on your mind about gun policies?
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Enjoy your program.
Thanks.
Just wondering how your guests would respond to Illinois, specifically Cook County, having the toughest gun laws in the nation and the highest murder rate.
Milt, thank you for that. Jerry, what do you make of that in the Chicago area?
Yeah, so we hear this frequently, and a couple of things to know is that, one, Chicago actually lost a number of its gun laws. They were found to be unconstitutional. So they don't actually have the toughest gun laws in the country. But two, and more importantly, and more to your point, Chicago does not have the highest firearm homicide rate in the country by far. They have, if you're looking at raw numbers, they have a lot of gun homicides. But if you're looking at rate, the actual risk that people experience, so the number of gun homicides per 100,000 people, Chicago isn't anywhere near the top. Instead, what we see is that cities like St. Louis and Houston and others have much higher firearm homicide rates. And if you're trying to link gun laws with those homicide rates, those cities that actually have the higher firearm homicide rates have very loose gun laws.
I want to look more closely at the red flag law, because as we look outside of Wisconsin and in New York, which has very tough gun laws, red flag law enacted 2019 should have prevented the Buffalo shooter from getting a gun, and it didn't. What should we take away from that moment?
Well, I don't know all of the specifics about New York's extreme risk protection order law, but I believe what I have seen is that it didn't apply to him because he was underage at the time. And so I think that's something that probably should be looked at. But we do know that these laws, extreme risk protective orders, while not preventing every act of gun violence, have certainly been helpful in preventing some gun violence, particularly firearm suicides.
Hmm. 19 states and D.C. have red flag laws, or these, as you said, these extreme risk protection laws on the books. Wisconsin does not. What is WAVE, your organization, doing in this area?
Well, we're certainly encouraging the legislature to do this. As I said, it seems to have the greatest impact on firearm suicide prevention. And here in the state of Wisconsin, every year, between 70 and 80% of our firearm deaths are actually firearm suicides. And these are occurring in all parts of the state, but particularly rural areas. So legislators who don't typically think that their part of their responsibility is dealing with gun violence are actually wrong. Their citizens are at greater risk here in the state of Wisconsin, and an extreme risk protection order, or ERPL law, would actually be tremendously helpful for the people they represent.
We're discussing policies aimed at reducing gun violence. Jerry Bonavia with us, founding director of Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort Educational Fund, or WAVE. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jerry, did the legislature or the governor take any actions this past session that you think will help reduce gun violence?
Yeah, so unfortunately, our legislature passed a number of bills that would put us in greater risk. So allowing guns on school grounds, allowing younger people to carry concealed weapons. And thankfully, our governor vetoed those bills, which I think was incredibly helpful in preventing us from going to an even worse place.
Well, one of the proposals that you mentioned and, you know, got to the governor's desk, vetoed this session, would have allowed people with concealed carry licenses to have a weapon in their vehicle on school property. And what we heard from Republican supporters is that gun owners who forget their weapons in their cars shouldn't risk being charged with a felony if they drive onto school grounds to drop off or pick up their kid. Is this a legitimate concern?
I think it's pretty telling when your best argument is that we are so irresponsible, we can't keep track of where our gun is and where we have it. I don't think that that's a great argument for why we should allow people with guns onto school grounds.
One thing the governor did do was fund some additional gun violence prevention programs. What do you see there in our last minute together?
I think it's incredibly important. I think that what we have seen is that funding for violence interruption and prevention programs for the organizations that actually have people out on the street working to interrupt cycles of violence. We've seen that that has been, you know, very useful in other places, and I'm really glad that the governor, you know, has decided to put some money into those kinds of programs.
Do you think those types of programs are affecting or helping what you're seeing transpire in Milwaukee?
I do. I think that, you know, unfortunately right now, in, as you mentioned, 2020, and then even worse in 2021, we're in a really bad place right now. And I think it's, you know, incredibly helpful that we have some programs, or we would be in an even worse spot.
Jerry, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Jerry Bonavia runs the Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort Education Fund. That is a grassroots group founded in 1997. Ahead this hour, the State Capitol Report continues with a look at another lingering issue before state lawmakers, whether or not to legalize marijuana. Join in on that question, where you want to see the policy discussion head, 800-642-1234. Stay with us. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Marijuana Policy Project, it calls Wisconsin stubbornly behind the times, one of 19 states that hasn't decriminalized simple possession of cannabis, one of 13 with no medical marijuana law. Join in on the future of marijuana policy as you see it in Wisconsin, what direction you want state lawmakers to go, 800-642-1234. Lee Hanna is an associate professor of political science at Wright State University, writing a book about the rise of legal marijuana in the U.S. Lee, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
Good morning. As you see it, you know, Democratic Governor Evers has proposed legalizing marijuana for medical and recreational use as part of last year's state budget. Our Republican-controlled legislature rejected that, stripped that out of the budget. How do you see Democrats and Republicans debating legalization across the land in other states?
Yes. So one thing that has made Wisconsin quite unique is, as Marijuana Policy Project put it, they really are a laggard in this issue. If you look at the general politics of the state, if you look at something like, you know, the Democratic vote share in presidential elections, or even the fact that there's a Democratic governor, you know, Wisconsin kind of stands out along with you know, some of the most conservative states in the Southeast, and then a few states that are still, you know, not moving forward on marijuana reform in the Midwest. But it really does kind of stick out if you look at the politics. As we look across the country at states that have adopted medical programs or adult use slash recreational programs, one of the most important ways that the conversation has really been started in states, and that the agenda has kind of moved to dealing with marijuana policy, has been through the popular initiative. And so, you know, I'm talking to you from Ohio. In 2016, our state legislature, with a Republican trifecta, took up medical marijuana and passed a bill that's actually been pretty effective. But they mainly did that because there was a threat that an initiative was going to be on the ballot in 2016. And a lot of Republicans didn't really want to go up on a ballot with a popular medical marijuana bill as well. And so they got to moving very quickly to get something passed. And that's one thing that we don't see in Wisconsin is that there's, I know that you have like advisory initiatives, but there's not as much, there aren't as many mechanisms in place for citizens to take action and directly affect legislation like they can in several of these states that do have medical or recreational cannabis.
Oh, that's interesting, because as you've been talking about, statewide ballot initiatives legalizing marijuana in other states, like Michigan, for instance, our neighbor. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that pressure of voter-approved initiatives versus adopting a legalization program, whether it's medical or recreational, through the legislative process?
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, at least in Ohio, the argument was that the legislators would want to have more control over the policy. And so they could have their committees, they could, you know, bring in expert witnesses and have testimony and write it up in a way. Now, of course, they're leaning on other states to kind of learn from their experiences, but write it up in a way to where they thought they had kind of maximum control, where organizations like Marijuana Policy Project or Americans for Safe Access, they will certainly dialogue with state legislatures, but they also have kind of their ideal legislation that they're going to be pushing for as well. Mm. And if they can get that verbatim on a ballot, you know, that can be pretty powerful. So so there is some negotiation, but we've seen in several states, even especially with some of the early adoptions. And I mean, you can go back to 1996 with California. In many cases, you had a citizenry ready for medical cannabis, and recreational doesn't come on until 2012. And the legislators were still afraid to touch it, just because of the stigma and all of the associations that kind of come with marijuana policy at times. And so in those cases, the ballot initiative is what the law is actually based upon, rather than, you know, legislators acting because they were worried about a ballot initiative.
And meanwhile, the public opinion is evolving, and you see that mm-hmm. through polling. Our recent Marquette University Law School poll says public support for legalizing of marijuana, it's growing here in Wisconsin. It was they took the pulse on it last in February, earlier this year. So 61% of people said they favor legalization. How is public opinion influencing what other states take on with legalization?
Yes, well, I definitely think it's happening in two ways. So certainly for kind of liberals who are, you know, more likely to support these policies kind of, you know, at the start, it gives them more, you know, more evidence that they're kind of in line with majority opinion. So it allows them to maybe push more, because, you know, there's two things when we think about being an elected leader. One is that, you know, that you vote on popular policy and that you push popular policy, you know, in a way to get reelected. And so the extent that they're, you know, not too far out in front of the public is helpful. And so I think we've seen, you know, Democrats kind of universally come on board. It's been a major part of language in the 2016 and 2020 national party platforms. Republicans have been more, you know, more averse to take this on, but certainly it is adding pressure as well, either when it's framed kind of from a revenue point of view, or if it's if you just kind of keep it in kind of the medical space rather than the adult use, that can also be pretty popular, especially if you're putting in front of this movement people who need medical cannabis the most, which is often families with you know, children with epilepsy. It's veterans coming back from the, you know, global wars on terror with PTSD and other injuries. When you start to put those, you know, recipients of this this program front and center, that has also been a way that we've seen more Republicans get on board.
Talking about marijuana legalization with Lee Hanna, political scientist who studies it from Wright State University. You can join in on where policy you think is headed in Wisconsin, 800-642-1234. I know you've said over time the medical marijuana discussion has really grown to include more groups of people battling ailments like cancer, as you mentioned, and epilepsy, veterans. How do you think that has affected attitudes and ultimately laws on the books for medical marijuana programs?
Yes, one thing that we've seen in some of these states that have adopted recently is that they do have almost kind of a poster child of the movement, you know, that's helping to move it forward. In West Virginia, it was a cancer patient who's still been a really active advocate kind of within their legislature. They passed in 2017. In Pennsylvania, it was actually a Republican leader who had his own story of recovering from cancer and going to New Jersey to get medical cannabis because it was so effective in his treatment. And so I do think that some of those types of stories can maybe even be more powerful than some of the broader evidence of, you know, the success of the policy or, you know, what the medical research is showing or something along those lines. And so that's certainly been a way that we've seen this policy slowly advance. And then also in state politics, we talk about this idea of policy diffusion, you know, how a policy spreads across the country. And one thing you notice is that when a state like Kansas is debating medical cannabis and they don't have a policy yet, it's a lot easier for a Republican legislator to say, oh, look at this nice conservative state like Ohio and West Virginia. You know, they have it and it's, you know, the sky hasn't fallen. So, you know, you can kind of use that where if you look at the early adopters, it was all kind of your most liberal states. It was the Northeast and the West Coast. And so as it's kind of spread across the country, I think that kind of adds some kind of subliminal pressure that this policy isn't just for liberal states or conservative states, but, you know, has some more broad appeal.
Well, let's bring on a caller now. Lori is joining us from Shawano. Hi, Lori. Go ahead.
Hi. A couple of years ago, you had a Republican politician from Wisconsin on, and I asked him about why medical marijuana at least wasn't legal in this country. And he said that because it's not federally recognized yet as legal, that they didn't want to do that. But yet, isn't heroin and fentanyl, don't they have the same derivative? And yet, fentanyl is legal, and it's killing people. But as far as I know, marijuana doesn't do anything.
Lori, thank you for that. And Lori pointing out that the federal and state, you know, marijuana policy gap that is also widening here, mm-hmm. Lee Hanna.
Yes, that's a great question and a great comment. So back in the 70s, the Controlled Substances Act was passed and it put marijuana on the same schedule of drugs called Schedule One with other drugs that have no medical use and are highly addictive. So it's on the same schedule as heroin and LSD and, you know, some of these other really strong drugs. And that has continued to make this this evolution of medical cannabis really challenging. And it's what most kind of proponents point to as maybe the quickest fix in marijuana policy would be to move to reschedule cannabis. And it matters for a few reasons. One, it makes medical research really expensive and almost totally prohibitive because you have to have special Schedule One licensing. You have to pay for all these extra security protocols. You can only get cannabis until very recently from one federal farm in Mississippi. So for all those reasons, we have very little kind of gold standard medical research like we do for most medications, most vaccinations, you know, et cetera. So that's one problem. And then the other problem is just as states do legalize the use of marijuana, they are running in the face of federal law. And so the Obama administration, through a few ways that they directed their Department of Justice, really did allow states to add more regulations and have more control and have less fear of federal intervention. But they didn't do anything to really institutionalize that. And it still means that our whole cannabis world is kind of on this unsure legal footing. Oh. Even Clarence Thomas made a comment about this. He recently in a decision said that federal policies of the last 16 years have greatly undermined its reasoning. The federal government's current approach is half in, half out regime that simultaneously tolerates and forbids local use of marijuana. Mm-hmm. In some ways, he's even questioning old precedents around cannabis laws and whether the court should revisit it.
Lee Hanna with us, associate professor of political science at Wright State, studying marijuana legalization in the U.S., explaining this kind of limbo and policy gap. Marijuana regulation in Wisconsin, where do you want to take the policy conversation on cannabis? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute for more State Cap here on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about where you want to take the cannabis question in Wisconsin. Join in with your take on medical and recreational marijuana, 800-642-1234. We have Associate Professor of Political Science at Wright State University. Lee Hanna is with us for about 9 more minutes. So, Lee, we're talking there about what's happening at the federal level and how that impacts state policies. And the Congressional Research Service, they just issued this report a few weeks ago that basically said, look, Congress has 4 options available to deal with this federal-state policy gap. One is do nothing. 2, strict enforcement of the federal prohibition. Or 3, you know, make these modest changes to protect state markets. Or 4, go full on federal legalization. What do you think? What direction makes sense at this point?
The direction I predict seems to be do nothing.
behind door number one? Well, inaction.
yes. That tends to be the answer in most cases. They have some modest efforts that have made their way through the House at different points and have kind of stalled out at that point. When they talk about modest ways to kind of protect this industry, there's a couple of major concerns. One is related to banking and finance. Because of federal prohibition, it makes getting into this industry a very it creates all kinds of challenges that other entrepreneurs just do not face. Everything from the inability to write off certain expenses for the business, as well as just issues with using credit cards, issues with using banks, using accounting services, everything kind of streams down from that. And mm-hmm. So that's one of the major challenges. And then second, there are just a number of issues about this situation we see ourselves in, where we have this legacy of the war on drugs, which, you know, has radically altered tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people's lives. And at the same time, we have, people cashing in on legal marijuana here in 2022. And, so that kind of hypocrisy and that challenge has really come forward as well. And so what do you do about expunging records, for example? What do you do about giving second chances to people who would maybe want to get into this industry but are prohibited because of state laws about, past records? Mm-hmm. What do you do about communities that have been harmed by the war on drugs? And so a lot of that has been worked into some of these new ways that states and especially progressives are thinking about cannabis as we move forward.
Let's take another call now. Matt is with us from Janesville. Matt, hi. What's on your mind?
I'd like to excerpt to talk about Wisconsin-specific OWI laws and operating with restricted controlled substances laws with medical marijuana, because the active substance in marijuana can stay in your bloodstream for more than 12 hours. Wisconsin, I think it's a little bit different because there's a zero tolerance level for traffic.
And Matt, you're breaking up. Can you still hear us?
I can still hear you. Yep.
Okay, good. So you're wanting to look at that intersection between our driving under the influence law restrictions and, regarding medical marijuana usage, especially if we have a zero tolerance type of policy. Where can you take that, Lee Hanna?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say two of the biggest kind of public health concerns pushing against marijuana legalization. One is teenage use and teenage access. And I would say studies on the whole have shown that there hasn't been a major increase in teen use, but it's still something that researchers are tracking. And then the second is kind of these broader questions for law enforcement about how to deal with OVIs, how to deal with kind of the changing landscape of marijuana law. And I'm sure that this probably is most challenging in some of the border towns where they're running right up against either recreational or medical cannabis and, you know, kind of how to deal with that. And that's still something I think that is in process in terms of both where the research is and kind of understanding this, but also just some technological questions and constitutional questions about how you can, you know, both ensure public safety, but also have appropriate data, you know, related to, you know, someone who has, you know, maybe under the influence of cannabis.
Talking with Lee Hanna, political scientist from Wright State University, looking at the marijuana legalization and what he's seen with states around the country. Lee, I want to talk about what happened here last month. Republican lawmakers, they hold this 5-hour public hearing on a medical marijuana measure, but the legislative session has adjourned for the year. Still, this was first time since Republicans took control of the legislature in 2011, any type of marijuana legalization measure has received a public hearing. How important is public testimony?
Yes, I think it's really critical to at least open the door to this conversation. And I think one thing you do see, and I really followed Ohio's law closely and you know, talked with some legislators about that, is that in many cases, even though people are kind of aware that it's popular and aware that it's a growing policy, some of the real details people don't really think about until, you know, maybe they're finally in the room with you know, somebody giving testimonial, whether that's personal testimony about, you know, how medical cannabis has been, you know, effective for them, or just more of your technocratic type of advice about how to make this policy work in a way that, you know, that it will be successful on a number of metrics. I think that is important to hold a hearing. You know, it's hard to know whether it was a real good faith effort to learn more, to come back to this, or if it was just a way to try to diffuse some pressure without any goal of action. But I would say in most states, the medical marijuana conversation occurs over several years, several legislative sessions before it really takes off. And so it's at least a sign that there may be some openness to it.
We only have less than a minute left. Mm-hmm. One thing about this bill, it would create a medical commission to oversee the dispensing of medical marijuana through these qualified primary care providers. How often are states creating like a framework, a regulatory body as part of legalization?
I would say since 2010 and the Obama administration changed some guidance on federal enforcement, that almost every state has come in with more regulations and more of a regulatory apparatus. It often goes to the Department of Health. In Ohio, our Commerce Department, as well as our Pharmacy Department, oversees this. And so there are a number of models out there for how to everything from inspecting the products to, you know, to regulating kind of how the businesses would come in and bid for licenses and get up and running. All of that has been kind of spelled out, and there are plenty of examples in the dozen or so states that have adopted recently.
Lee, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. This was great.
Lee Hanna is a political scientist from Wright State University, a researcher of marijuana legalization. Just ahead, we speak with a representative from the Wisconsin Pest Control Association. Now that insects are starting to crowd out of their winter homes and into ours, what questions do you have about controlling infestations? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.